The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Well, good evening. While the handout is going around, sort of a tradition, I'm an academic, you get a handout. I'll just spend a minute or so very quickly introducing myself. My name is Roger Jackson, and I teach primarily South Asian and Tibetan religions at Carleton College down in Northfield. I did my graduate work at the University of Wisconsin, and most of my scholarly work has been in the field of Indian and Tibetan Buddhism, with an emphasis on philosophy, meditation systems, poetry, ritual. You live long enough, you end up studying a whole range of different things. I've got a particular interest, I guess I would say, in issues about the nature of mind, both from a kind of metaphysical standpoint and from a contemplative standpoint. Much of my recent work has been on the Tibetan meditative system known as the Great Seal or Mahamudra. Which may or may not be the same as Nibbana, but I'm not sure we'll find that out tonight. I've been practicing Buddhism about as long as I've been studying it, and I'm not sure which I do worse, but nevertheless, my practice has mostly been in Tibetan traditions, especially the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, but I've studied with teachers in other Tibetan schools and have also spent time with some Zen practice and mindfulness practice as well. So I've been around various blocks, you might say. I'm really pleased to be asked to speak here. This is the third time I've come, I believe. I want to thank everybody for showing up on a beautiful spring night that probably insists on all sorts of other directions for you. Everybody who's hosting me and helped make the arrangements, I thank as well. And I particularly want to thank in absentia Mark Nunberg for suggesting a topic on which I have absolutely no qualifications to speak, namely Nibbana/Nirvana. However, I'm slightly consoled by the fact that if we take Theravadan orthodoxy at its word today, there is nobody presently living who is qualified to speak on the topic. Because there are no arhats. So I'll do the best I can from a standpoint. Again, Mark asked me if since as a sort of a scholar of Buddhism, I could talk about it somewhat from an academic angle. That's what I propose to do, and I hope it's illuminating, if not thoroughly enlightening. So I want to start off by just talking a little bit about Nibbana/Nirvana. And I trust all of you know that Nibbana is simply the Pali term and Nirvana the Sanskrit term for the same X. I'm not even sure what word to use. And it's perhaps moderately useful to start out with an etymological approach to it. In the Pali canon, the term turns up numerous times, certainly, though it's far from the most common term for the liberated state. You probably find the word vimutti, which means liberation, much more commonly than you do Nibbana. But over the course of time, Nibbana came to be the standard term. That took some doing. Anyway, if we take it for a moment in its original Sanskrit form, and as again, I suspect most of you know, Pali is a sort of variant on Sanskrit. It's what's called a Prakrit, a later development of the Sanskrit language. Anyway, Nirvana, if we take the Sanskrit form, comes from a verbal root that means to blow, va. And the nir is in Sanskrit or Pali or pretty much any Indic language a privative or a negative prefix. And so nirvana in that sense means to blow out or to be blown out, hence the title of, at least the beginning of the title of my talk. And it's, again, perhaps moderately interesting that it's obviously used as a noun, as in the attainment of nirvana, but it also can be both a verb and an adjective. So you have verbal forms that we would, that don't translate very well into English, as in X or Y nirvanized, or nirvanic as an adjective. Anyway, that's the fundamental etymological meaning of it, is a sense of blowing out, or again being blown out. And the sense that the term has in Indic languages, broadly speaking, is specifically with reference to the extinction or the blowing out of a fire or a flame or some kind of afflictive heat. And it's worth noting too that it's not just Buddhists who use this term. If you read around in Indian religious literature, if you read Hindu sources, Jain sources in particular, the Ajivikas were another important early school, but we don't have very much by them. But all these schools use the term nirvana with greater or lesser degrees of emphasis and seriousness. If you're thinking particularly about Hindu traditions, where nirvana comes up with regularity, it's used in the Bhagavad Gita several times. In fact, it's a sense of it that is related to Buddhist meanings, but of course it ends up being understood within the context of Hindu metaphysics. And so we can't assume that simply because different traditions are using the same term, they're meaning it in the same way. This is a common problem in the study, particularly of mystical states and mystical experiences. The basic Buddhist sense of the term, I think, is best to understand it within the context of the kind of cosmology that early Buddhism found itself in the midst of. And this is a cosmology that many scholars refer to in a kind of shorthand way as the samsara nirvana cosmology, or you could call it the samsara moksha cosmology if you want to focus on a term that Hindus tend to use with great frequency. And when I say cosmology, I mean not the beginnings of things. We sometimes think about cosmology in terms of astrophysics nowadays, but cosmology in the religious studies sense of the term means the basic way in which a culture or a group of people or a philosophical tradition, whatever it may be, thinks the universe is set up in the most basic way. So you might say that in Western theistic traditions like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, at the most fundamental level, there is God and there is God's creation. And God's creation then is divided in various ways. But certainly in Christianity and Islam, you've got a very clear sense of heaven and hell. And then you've got subdivisions, different sorts of beings that exist within that cosmology. Anyway, most Indic schools, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, and others from about the 5th century BC on have basically accepted that the universe is set up so that there are two possibilities for the beings in it. There is samsara, which is, of course, the sort of repeated, unwanted taking of rebirth, after rebirth, after rebirth. And then there is an alternative to that. There is a condition, a state, call it what you will. Maybe X is really best. There is this X that is outside of that, that transcends that, that is an end to that. And that's the sort of basic cosmology in which the term nirvana turns up at the beginnings, in the very beginnings of the Buddhist tradition. Perhaps another way to think about this, if we think as I think early Buddhists did, that samsara is a fundamentally undesirable condition, a condition from which we want to escape, and that condition is understood in a fairly literal sense, again, as involving repeated rebirth, then nirvana is the limit of that. It's the stopping of that. And it's also the concept, if you will, against which the suffering of samsara is best measured. So if you think about the First Noble Truth, the fact that there is suffering, This actually is a big stumbling block for many people. Once you get past the obvious fact that we all are dissatisfied in various ways and at various times, but the kind of stronger claim implied by the truth of suffering, that existence here and existence in any condition within the sentient cosmos is fundamentally unsatisfactory, fundamentally diseased, if you will, only really can be easily accepted, I think, if you have as a contrast the possibility that there is a condition that completely transcends that. So the truth of suffering, in a way, is only true if nirvana is a possibility. To put it in, to slightly paraphrase John Lennon, nirvana is a concept by which we measure our dukkha. We understand our suffering in relation to the possibility of nirvana. Without the possibility of nirvana, then suffering has to be readjusted. And we talk about pleasure, we talk about pain, and we talk about the relativity of all of that. We only can accept that our condition is thoroughly unsatisfactory if there actually is a condition outside of that, and that would be nirvana. So that in a very broad sense is one way of thinking about how I think nirvana was probably imagined at the very beginnings of the Buddhist tradition. There are a whole range of different synonyms for the term. I've already hinted at this, and among those that turn up commonly in the Pali Canon are vimutti, which means something like liberation, vimukti in Sanskrit, arhata, which is the state of arhatship or arhantship, and the arhant is, of course, in the Pali Canon and in Theravada tradition more broadly, the spiritual ideal, the highest attainment that one can possibly reach, and it involves, of course, a liberation from samsara. Nibbuti, the state of stopping transformations or changes. This is nivritti in Sanskrit, and it's very interesting. This is just a little kind of scholarly footnote. At the beginning of his Yoga Sutra, Patanjali says, Yogash chitta vritti nirodha. It's the stopping of the fluctuations of mind. And this term, nibbuti, has very much that same sense. Stopping of change, the stopping of time, the stopping of fluctuation. Samsara is nothing if not fluctuation. Nirodha, again, cessation. There are many other terms that are synonymous as well. But all this, it seems to me, begs a question, which is whether we really can talk about nirvana or nibbana. If you look at nirvana is, after all, a kind of limit term. It's a term that, by definition, transcends what we have, know, and experience here in our own situation. And if we were to, for the sake of argument, consider it a mystical state of some sort, then the common problem of ineffability arises. It's often claimed that mystical experiences cannot really be described or discussed. They are ineffable. And actually the literature in the Pali Canon points you a little bit in this direction, because it's very clear that in various ways the Buddha was quite reluctant to talk about nirvana or what it really was. And a good deal of the discourse surrounding nirvana in the Pali Canon, in the various Nikayas in particular, but also in the Abhidharma, and to the degree that it comes up in the Vinaya there as well, the language is often quite negative. So you have, for instance, a famous passage in the Samyutta Nikaya, which I'll just read very briefly here, only a segment of it. This is somebody actually conversing with Sariputta, the Buddha's great disciple. Friend Sariputta, it is said, Nibbana, Nibbana. What now is Nibbana? And Sariputta says, the destruction of lust, the destruction of hatred, the destruction of delusion, this, friend, is called Nibbana. Now that, of course, tells you something because it identifies the classic three poisons that are kind of at the hub of the wheel of samsara and keep us going in samsara in various ways. But this is describing Nibbana by indirection, by what it isn't. It doesn't really tell you very much about what it is. By the same token, there is a kind of classic description of Nibbana that's found in the Udana. This is, a reasonably early set of kind of inspiring and uplifting utterances. That's what Udana means, it's kind of uplifting. One of the most famous of all the accounts of Nibbana is found in the Udana. And this is the Buddha speaking. He says, "There is, monks, that base where there is neither earth nor water nor heat nor air, neither the base of the infinity of space nor the base of the infinity of consciousness nor the base of nothingness nor the base of neither perception nor non-perception, neither this world nor another world, neither sun nor moon. Here, monks, I say, there is no coming, no going, no standing still, no passing away, and no being reborn. It is not established, not moving, without support. Just this is the end of suffering." Again, that tells you a great deal about what Nibbana isn't and not a great deal about what Nibbana is. The Buddha actually goes on in this same text in the Udana, these inspiring statements, to say, "There is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from that which is born, become, made, conditioned. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore an escape is discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned." That kind of wonderful repetitiousness that the Pali Canon treats us to all the time. But this notion that if there weren't this state that we really can't describe, there would be no release from that which is made, become, conditioned, i.e. from samsara. In a very similar context, and I think similarly famously, there is a passage, it occurs, I think, in a number of different places, but its most notable location is in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha is asked about the destiny, if you will, or the state of the Tathagata. The Tathagata is the Buddha, of course. The state of the Tathagata after his passing into final nirvana. So the interlocutor here, Vachagota, says, "When a monk's mind is liberated, Master Gotama, where is he reborn after death? Is reborn does not apply, Vacha. Then is he not reborn, Master Gotama? Is not reborn does not apply, Vacha. Then he both is reborn and is not reborn, Master Gotama? Both is reborn and is not reborn does not apply, Vacha. Then he neither is reborn nor is not reborn, Master Gotama? Neither is reborn nor is not reborn does not apply, Vacha." Vacha is very confused by this, as people have been for some 2,500 years now. But the Buddha kind of goes on and he says, "What do you think, Vacha? Suppose a fire were burning before you. Would you know this fire is burning before me?" And he says, "Of course I would, Master Gotama. If that fire before you were to be extinguished, would you know this fire before me has been extinguished? I would, Master Gotama. If someone were to ask you, Vacha, when that fire before you was extinguished, to which direction did it go? To the east, the west, the north, or the south? Being asked thus, what would you answer? That does not apply, Master Gotama. The fire burned in dependence on its fuel of grass and sticks. When that is used up, if it does not get any more fuel, being without fuel, it is reckoned as extinguished." The Buddha says, exactly. Liberated from reckoning in terms of form, the Tathagata is deep, immeasurable, hard to fathom, like an ocean. Is reborn does not apply, is not reborn does not apply. Both is reborn and is not reborn does not apply. Neither is reborn nor is not reborn does not apply. The Tathagata has abandoned, and then it goes on to list the five aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, dispositions, and consciousness. So again, you cannot say what nirvana is. And if you were to sort of stop with these three examples, the temptation would be, well, you know, we should all go home, or I should shut up at least. And you know, end of story. And it's simply a thoroughly negative nothing, and nothing can be said about it. But of course, it's not that simple. You can already pick up, even in these negative statements, intimations of more positive descriptions of some nirvana. And in fact, as you work through the Pali Canon, you find many different ways in which it is described much more positively. For instance, the famous Questions of King Milinda, which is one of the first great philosophical texts of the Theravada tradition, a series of dialogues between a Greek king and a Buddhist monk somewhere in the northwest of India. You have a whole series of questions that this king poses to the monk. And I won't go into all the details of the discussions, but the king poses some very sharp and interesting questions. But at the very beginning of it, Nagasena, the monk, establishes clearly for the king that nirvana is bliss. And so here you have at least a positive way of describing this. And in fact, as you work through other portions of the Pali Canon, you find that there are all sorts of different images and metaphors for nirvana that are used. And just, I've got some of them listed on the handout here. The far shore, the subtle, the stable, the peaceful, the auspicious, the secure, the wonderful, the amazing, purity, freedom, the shelter, the refuge, the destination. All this begins to build up for you a kind of image. Other images and all these, in fact, come from one very particular portion in the Samyutta Nikaya, where all these metaphors for or images for nirvana are used. Elsewhere in the Pali Canon, other images that are repeatedly used come up. Light, as in enlightenment, even though enlightenment is a kind of incorrect English translation of a word that means awakening. I suspect some of you probably know that. The ocean, we saw that actually come up here. The kind of immeasurability of the ocean, the profundity of the ocean is used as to exemplify nirvana. An island, that is this safe destination amidst the raging waters of samsara. You can think about samsara as a raging fire, in which nirvana is the cooling out, the blowing out. Or you can think about samsara as a river, as an ocean, and nirvana as being a safe island in the midst of that. You can think about it as like space. And this is always a useful metaphor, because if you're tempted to concretize nirvana too much by thinking of it as an island or an ocean or whatever it may be, then space is an image that shows you its immateriality, its lack of anything much like the physical world that we live in. It's sometimes described as a city, this destination that you reach through by sort of hacking through the jungle of samsara. And it's often described as health. And as we know, the Buddha is often described as a kind of physician. And samsara is our dis-ease. Dukkha is literally dis-ease or unease. And nirvana is an achievement of a kind of permanent state of health. So anyway, you have all these kind of positive images of it. And, I mean, that's good, and that's probably comforting in some ways, because we don't have to rest entirely with these negative ways of describing it, but it does leave the reader or the listener with a lot of unanswered questions about, well, which is it? Not that it necessarily has to be both, of course. Paradox is rife in religious situations and religious discourse like this, but I think that one way, a solution might be a little strong as a way of putting this, but one way to think about when negative language is used and when positive language is used is to think about a distinction that was made early on in the Buddhist tradition. And that's a distinction into two types of nibbana. There is a nibbana with so-called residue remaining. In Pali, this is sopatisesa nibbana. And then nibbana without residue remaining, anopatisesa nibbana. And the passage in which this is originally stated makes it clear that the nibbana with some kind of residue remaining is essentially what the Buddha achieved at the age of 35 sitting under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. That is, he achieved a state in which he no longer was generating any negative karma because he no longer was generating greed or hatred or any kind of negativity, because he had seen the actual nature of reality and therefore was no longer confused about it. He had awakened to it. But he had residues remaining in the sense that he still had his body, he still had his senses, he still had, in fact, various karmic causes whose results had to play out. So the Buddha could, in fact, get sick. he died eventually of a disease. Brought on, it seems, by eating some very bad pork. If you insist that he was a vegetarian, then it was bad mushrooms. But in any case, that's nibbana with residue. And not just the Buddha, but any arhat, anybody who has achieved liberation, will, before they die, before they pass into final nirvana, similarly have achieved nibbana with residue. So nibbana without residue then is what happens at the point where an awakened being, an arhat, a Buddha, dies. And this is often called parinibbana. And at that point, you know, for instance, when the Buddha wouldn't talk about whether a Tathagata is, you know, exists or doesn't or both or neither after death, this is the type of nirvana that he's unwilling to say anything about. We can say about the, if you will, psychological condition of someone who is awakened but still alive, that they have bliss, they have knowledge, they have peace, they have stability, and so forth. So the describable indescribable actually tends to fall along this axis, and it depends to some degree on whether you're talking about someone who's awakened and still alive in this body, or someone who has passed completely beyond the body and any need to be reborn again. So you have these contrasting terms. You have Bodhi as the awakening that the Buddha achieved under the tree, sometimes contrasted with Nibbana, meaning what happens after such a person passes away. But in other cases, you'll talk about Nibbana being equivalent to what you have when you're still alive, and then Parinibbana as what you get when you pass beyond all suffering and any need to be reborn. Or they talk sometimes about the Nibbana of the kleshas, the afflictions or defilements, greed, hatred, ignorance, and so forth, and that's what you achieve under your equivalent of the Bodhi tree. Or the kanda or skanda nibbana, that is when you go completely beyond the five skandas, the five aggregates that make up the so-called person for Buddhism. So this is another thing that makes reading about and discussing nibbana tricky, because the term is used in different ways in different places, and you have to read the context to understand what's going on with it. I'm going to say a little bit about the place of nibbana in Theravada discourse. Some of these points I think are fairly obvious, but I want more than anything else just to raise some of the questions that were discussed among Theravadan scholastics over the course of the many centuries. One of these, if you think about Nibbana as in some sense the culmination of the path to arhantship, right? It's what you get at the end of the path. There are interesting questions, I think not entirely resolved in the Pali Canon itself, as to whether the way you get there is through meditation that primarily focuses on the jhanas, on the absorbed, these kind of concentrated absorptions, or do you achieve it through mindfulness, as in the famous Satipatthana Sutra, the sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. These, as you may know, are two allied but rather different approaches to meditation, both of which are recognized by Buddhism. And in the Pali Canon, at least, there's no final solution to this question. If anything, there may be more of a tendency in the Pali Canon to think that Nibbana is at the end of a path that takes you through the various absorptions, the first through fourth jhanas, and then, you know, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothing whatsoever, neither perception nor non-perception, perhaps even the so-called absorption of cessation, which is the highest samsaric point. And it may be that Nibbana is just at the end of that, but then in other places you'll see that no, that's not adequate. In fact, it's often said that the Buddha, after he left his palace and his family behind, when he first studied meditation, he studied with teachers who could help him get instantly. He was a very skilled meditator, through benefit of past lives, perhaps. And he almost instantly was able to achieve the states of nothing whatsoever and neither perception nor non-perception, but he thought that wasn't adequate. So there's some interesting questions there. Whether mindfulness meditation itself would be adequate for Nibbana without a lot of concentration meditation was, again, a kind of open issue. The Satipatthana Sutta says that, you know, if you practice this assiduously, if I assume many of you have read this, the rhetoric's wonderful at the end, you know, you can do this in as much as 3 months, and if you do it, you can do it in as much as 3 weeks, you know, 3 days, 1 day, even today you can do this. And it's inspiring, but again, the question remains open whether that in itself was adequate. Later, Theravada tradition insisted quite clearly that you had to have a combination of, in effect, samatha meditation, or calming meditation, and insight meditation. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why the fundamental meditative teachings in a place like Common Ground and most other mindfulness centers use those, and most Buddhist traditions, in fact, accept that combination of the two types of meditation is required. But again, the Pali Canon itself, things are not quite crystal clear about all this, and so it's hard to reconstruct, if we're interested in doing so, what the Buddha might actually have done and thought about these things. There are among those who have attained Nibbana, there are different sorts of beings, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but this relates to these questions about what meditation is proper for the attainment of Nibbana. And so there are two types of arhants recognized in Theravada tradition. Those that are called wisdom liberated arhants, and those are the ones who have sort of they've done their mindfulness meditation, but they haven't gone deeply into concentration meditation. They haven't risen through the jhanas. They certainly haven't gotten any of the various superpowers that are possible through concentration. They're sometimes called dry arhants because they don't have the kind of richness of meditative experience that someone who has explored the jhanas and beyond. And then you have those that are called both ways liberated, those who both have mindfulness and with it the understanding, for instance, of no self or the Four Noble Truths, but also a deep sense of concentration meditation. So you can there are various kinds of arhats. The Buddha, needless to say, is a both ways liberated arhat. He has the full range of experience of the meditative states and a completely profound insight into the actual nature of things. There are various, I'm going to skip over the problem of the cessation attainment, which is the state that I mentioned that sometimes is seen as the very peak of samsaric experience, and the problem of whether the state that is sometimes said to be so much like nirvana that you might think it was nirvana, but somehow it isn't, what this is like and what it's like to kind of waken from this state. Early scholars called it a cataleptic trance, but I think probably it's a bit subtler than that. Anyway, passing over that, one of the other interesting questions that came up among Theravadan scholars was the question of whether Nibbana had a cause. Because you think, after all, Nibbana, you practice the path, you know, you meditate assiduously, you practice ethical behavior and so forth, and the result is Nibbana, right? Wrong. Nibbana is, by definition, outside of any kind of causal chain. So, for instance, the questions of King Melinda, there's a bit of discussion of this. And Melinda tries to show the Greek king that somehow Nibbana is what happens at the end of the path. But you can't say that the path causes Nibbana, because if you said that the path cause Nibbana, then Nibbana, in effect, would be a conditioned entity of some sort, and it's completely beyond any kind of conditioning. And this is, you know, this is the kind of philosophical argument that some people love, and other people say, please, please don't even tell me about it. and I won't take a poll, but I just want to indicate that these are some of the issues that are out there. There's another way in which it's discussed in the Pali or Theravada tradition is, and I've indicated this already, is kind of the end of time and narrative. If you think about this in a personal sense, Nibbana is the closing of your own samsaric story. It's the denouement, if you will, of this tale told perhaps by a real idiot full of sound and fury that we've been telling ourselves since beginningless time. And this puts the end to it. But there's also, interestingly, and this is perhaps a secondary point, there is a kind of cosmic sense of Nibbana that's often discussed in Pali tradition as well, in which there is it's what's called the Nibbana of the relics. And while I suspect that relics are not something that is played up a great deal at a place like Common Ground, those of you who traveled in Asia or know a bit about Buddhism in other contexts will recognize that relics are tremendously important to Buddhists the world around. And the relics of the Buddha or any other kind of enlightened being are in fact considered to be almost a consolidation of the enlightened state. So they are Nibbana almost in a physical form. And so, be that as it may, there's the notion of time, of course, in Buddhism is cyclical, as in most Indic traditions. And there's texts that talk about how when the end of a world era comes, then all the relics of the Buddha, you know, which are spread in various parts of the world, will all sort of congregate in Bodh Gaya at the Bodhi tree, and all come together into the form of a kind of great Buddha, which will then sort of spontaneously combust, and that will be the end of the Buddhist dispensation for this time period, and it will be the end of the world for this time period. So there's a Nibbana of the world too, and of course we're all aware of that, all too well aware of that in our various contemporary contexts. A few other issues which I'll just mention, and not, again, I can't possibly answer these questions, but these were some of the sorts of issues that were discussed is, you know, okay, whose Nibbana is it, right? If there is no self, and if Nibbana is a condition in which that nothing like the five aggregates obtains, at least final Nibbana is like that, then can we even talk about, someone's achieving Nibbana? If I'm a no self, who achieves a state in which there are not five aggregates, then who does this? So again, some knotty problems. These are sort of Theravada koans, if you will. The question of whether we can desire Nibbana. After all, desire is said in the Buddha's very first teaching, Trishna or Tanha in Pali, which is craving or thirst, is said to be that which, you know, makes us be reborn. It's that which leads to suffering. And if desire is equivalent to this, and we desire nirvana, then do we have a problem? Maybe we do. Again, there's a fairly simple solution to this. It's a linguistic solution, which you discover when you begin to see that when people talk about desiring a partner or desiring food or desiring wealth, the word in Pali or Sanskrit is completely different from the word that means to, quote, desire nirvana. Really, you aspire to nirvana, you orient yourself to nirvana, and it's got a very different valence to it. But it leaves problems, and Zen had great fun with this, of course. The question, is nirvana God? It seems to be the limiting principle, the ultimate principle for Theravada Buddhism. And yet, fairly clearly, it doesn't match. And well, back up for a sec. If you think about some of the qualities of nirvana, they sound like qualities that are often attributed to God, say, in Western theistic traditions. But of course, nirvana doesn't have anything to do with the creation of the cosmos. Nirvana is not personal or personalized in any way. It doesn't undergird the cosmos, at least not in Theravada Buddhism. When it gets to Mahayana, things get a little stranger at times. But these are some of the sorts of questions. In the Abhidhamma traditions of kind of phenomenology of mind and detailed metaphysics, which is not everybody's cup of tea, shall we say, but is actually quite important. I think, in fact, people who do a lot of meditation have often scorned the Abhidhamma at the beginning and then come to realize, oh, there's a lot there that has things to say to us about meditation. Anyway, within the Abhidhamma tradition, this kind of scholastic, intellectual, philosophical tradition, nirvana is one of the sort of main types of elements that make up the cosmos. You know, there's different lists of dhammas or dharmas in the Abhidharma traditions, you know, ranging a number from 57 to 89 to 119. There's all sorts of different ways of kind of slicing the pie of the universe. But typically in Theravada, they talk about mind, mental factors or mental events, matter, and nirvana. And those are sort of the four basic divisions of what is. Another way they talk about it is compounded and uncompounded dharmas. Nibbana clearly is an uncompounded dharma, a dharma that is not produced in any way. It's like space in that respect, but it's also different from space because it represents a condition of complete freedom, which space does not. The question of whether Nibbana is permanent, I mean, if Buddhism teaches that everything is impermanent, and nirvana is described in such a way that makes it sound like it's permanent, what sense do we make of that? Are they violating their own rules, or is nirvana a special case that impermanence only applies on this side of the line of samsara? And, you know, by the same token, does nirvana have some kind of an inherent nature? Buddhists tend to reject an inherent nature of any sort, and yet nirvana is often described in ways that make it sound like it has one. Anyway, all these are questions the tradition perhaps never fully answered, although people made attempts, and I certainly am not going to. In the interest of time, and so there's a little bit of time for discussion, I'm unfortunately not going to say very much at all about nirvana in the Mahayana. Only to say that a couple of things very quickly. One is that there is a discourse in the Mahayana that tends to denigrate nirvana, whether it's in the Heart Sutra, where it's asserted there is no suffering, there is no origin, there is no cessation, i.e. nirvana, there is no path, to Nagarjuna's famous statement in the 25th chapter of his Fundamental Stanzas on Wisdom to the effect that there's no difference whatsoever between samsara and nirvana. Okay. Try that one out for size. To the Lotus Sutras, metaphor or parable of a kind of illusory city or oasis in the desert that a caravan leader establishes because people are weary of the length of the journey and need a resting place before they go on to their real destination. The analogy here, the oasis, this kind of illusory oasis, is the nirvana of the arhats, of the Hinayana, and the ultimate destination is full Buddhahood. And so the notion here is that what people in the early Buddhist traditions were aiming for was not fully adequate, that it was only a resting place on the way to complete Buddhahood, which all of us would ultimately attain. And often in Mahayana texts, there's a notion that we ought to specifically reject our own nirvana as bodhisattvas so that we can help all beings maximally. And yet the term is used a great deal in the Mahayana as well. Even the Heart Sutra goes on to say that bodhisattvas in the end attain nirvana. The Lotus Sutra actually talks about the eternity of the Buddha's nirvana, which is beginningless and endless. There's a whole theory that some of you may be aware of in the Mahayana, that the Buddha has three different bodies, kayas as they're called, which are in various ways functions of his nirvanic state. You have the whole famous Buddha nature theory also in the Mahayana, that all of us in some way, and perhaps all things even, already are in nirvana, but just don't realize it. So, I mean, you know, you get beyond that into tantric usages as well, and you can read various tantric poets, and on one, you know, in one verse, the famous poet Saraha will say, you know, if you give up worldly things and fancy nirvana, you're going to get nowhere. But then, you know, five verses later, he'll say, and this is the great nirvana. So, we'll leave Mahayana in that state of more or less utter confusion, and just touch very quickly at the end here on the whole question of nirvana today. I've been talking about the tradition and primarily about the Pali tradition, Theravada tradition. And I think, you know, when we as contemporary, for the most part in this room, Westerners, come to Buddhism and try to deal with a concept like nirvana, quite apart from its paradoxes and the uncertainties, if we think about it in some of the terms that I've read to you from Pali scriptures, the traditional assumptions, I think, are very difficult for many Westerners to accept. Just as the theory of rebirth is difficult for most Westerners to accept, I think it's fair to say that it's not part and parcel of our culture. I think there's a great deal of difficulty with that. So the sort of other side of that very traditional cosmology, nirvana, at least in the terms that it often has been described, is difficult for us to accept as well. That is, I would say specifically, the claim that it actually is possible for a human being to attain a, quote, perfected state. Our psychology, our own, if we have any kind of Judeo-Christian religious background, all these militate against the idea of human perfection on this earth, in this body. And so nirvana, in its traditional sense, is difficult for us. This is not to say it isn't the way Buddhists traditionally describe it. I'm only making an observation from having hung around Buddhist centers for 40 years now and talked to a lot of people. On the other hand, if you too quickly want to say, well, given that, we should really just try to understand nirvana psychoexistentially, right? Try to understand it as a state, simply a state where you're tranquil, you're balanced, you have a proper sense of proportion in your life, you don't give rise to great fits of desire or anger. You have a modicum of wisdom. If you say, well, let's just think of nirvana that way, okay? It's we can relate to that, right? Somebody who's, you know, in what Maslowian or Heideggerian terms is authentic, an authentic person. That person must have achieved nirvana. Well, then you're really, how much of the tradition are you really taking seriously at that point? I mean, this is a problem modern people face as religious people in all sorts of contexts. How seriously do Christians take Jesus's miracles? Well, maybe we can think about them symbolically. Okay, how about Jesus's resurrection? Is that just symbolic? Gets tricky. So I think with Buddhism, you've got similar issues that all of us who identify with Buddhism in one way or another face. These days, there's a whole other element to this, given the popularity of neuroscientific studies of meditative states. If the Theravada tradition is wrong, and there is an arhat somewhere, and an arhat could be cornered by Richie Davidson down in Madison and put the net on his head or her head, who knows, and you take readings of it, as of course Richie Davidson and other people in different neuroscientific labs around the country and around the world have done, meditative states become measurable states to some degree. And this raises all sorts of interesting questions about how that then does or does not relate to broader Buddhist metaphysical claims, broader Buddhist claims about nirvana. If you could find an arhat and put the electrode net on the arhat's head, and you'd say, well, okay, we can determine that this and this and this and this is going on in the brain, and this is actually a state that the technology is nowhere near this right now. It can only give you very general pictures about where blood goes and doesn't go and certain kind of electrical patterns. But let's say you could get a pretty precise picture. Would everybody just throw up their hands and say, well, okay, it's just a function of human physiology and all the metaphysical claims of Buddhism are wrong? I don't know. Probably not, but it's a tricky issue. So it brings me at the end to this notion that, and this is a cop-out, like almost anything necessarily will be, that there is a great deal of not knowing involved in trying to understand what nirvana is. And whatever it might be, it seems to be a principle that keeps us really humble and really modest. And it also represents, of course, for many people, an inspiration and a kind of ideal that perhaps can be attained. But every time we think we've got what it is, there's always some text, some person, some teaching, some problem that assures us that we don't quite get it. And in that sense, nirvana has the final word, if it's not the final word. So I haven't left as much time for conversation and questions as I'd like, but I'm happy to take any that anybody may have. Yeah.
So, inside of a classic Buddhist text at all, and is there anyone aside from the Buddha who's achieved nirvana, who's in a nirvanic condition?
Yes. Yes, yeah, nirvanized, nirvanified, right? Yeah, those are the arhats. Yeah, and the assumption is that the kind of classic account in Theravada tradition and in the Pali Canon itself is that during his lifetime, the Buddha helped at least 499 beings to achieve nirvana. Actually, it's considerably more than that. But the story of the first council, where supposedly the Buddha's teachings were recited and then centuries later written down, begins with the idea that at least of living people, there are only 499 arhats. This is after the Buddha's death. And they need one more. And Ananda, who actually is the one who has been closest to the Buddha, has not yet achieved arhatship, but then he does. They've got the necessary number of 500, and there begins this long recitation of the various things the Buddha had said, which eventually becomes the Pali Canon. So yes, and so the tradition's idea is that, remember, Buddhism has a cyclical sense of time, and it's also got a sense that we are in a declining historical cycle. So things now are not nearly as good. We live in, you know, as Indians would say, we live in the Kali Yuga, this dark age, in which spiritual practice is much more difficult than it was in the good old days when the Buddha lived. So that's one of the reasons the tradition says there are no arhats nowadays, is because the time is so corrupt, so spiritually inauspicious. But at least in the past, there were many beings who supposedly attained arhatship.
Yeah.
Just to add a different lens on that question, I was at a long retreat with Upandita, who comes from the Mahasa Sayadaw tradition, which is the great-grandfather of our tradition here. And at the end of the retreat, someone asked him this question, are there arhats now? And he scolded the question. This is not an appropriate question, but he said, but I'll humor you. He said, yes, there are arhats, but they don't wear signs on their chest.
Yeah.
Right.
No, and when I was in Sri Lanka many 20 years ago or so, I got to know a very deeply respected lay practitioner by the name of Godwin Samararatna, who ran a meditation center in Kandy. And I talked with him, meditated with him, studied with him some, and then had a Buddhist monk in. I was leading a student program and had a Buddhist monk in to lead a meditation for the students, and asked him afterwards, so is it true that there are no arhats alive these days, as tradition says? And he says, do you know Godwin Samararatna? I said, yeah. He says, just look at the way he does things and tell me what you think. I mean, it was not a direct answer, but the intimation was clear. So yeah, Orthodox tradition may say one thing, but who knows? And of course, there's this whole larger question of how it is that enlightenment is determined, right? On one level, it takes one to know one. And that's actually how Buddhist tradition often has operated. But on the other hand, there is a degree to which enlightenment is socially conferred, right? I mean, I don't mean to be reductionist about it or overly social scientific, but enlightenment is something that is recognized within a community according to standards that community establishes. It's not as if we can't tell. I can't tell, certainly, whether somebody is reading another person's mind saying, yeah, you got it. All we can do from the outside is to say, well, X or Y is considered enlightened. You know, do I know whether the Dalai Lama is enlightened? No, of course I don't. We can say for certain that within Tibetan communities, and even more broadly, he is accepted as being an enlightened being. Yeah.
A couple of things. I the duality of good and evil, and heaven and hell, and yin and yang, and it seems like the way Nirvana is described or mystically described, it attempts to erase the two.
Mm-hmm.
So then mm-hmm. I'm left, okay, mm-hmm. from the Taoist end, you would say the earth chi, which you can feel, is sensory. So that would fall away. So you're finding the energy, so that means you would have a yang energy as sort of this state. And that, I don't know, that was just the idea for me of if nirvana would be the idea of compassion, which is mm-hmm. separate from the idea of inspiration. So the compassion is the heart. So if the heart is compassionate, it can take a moment of disarray, chaos, suffering, and flip it around into a caring, loving moment,
mm-hmm.
then nirvana is touchable, and it is active, and it is in existence,
mm-hmm.
and it is within our control to do it, and it's also not separating out the forces of the world that need each other. That I just don't understand without one or the other. I don't know. It's just okay, beyond self and beyond reaching. So who cares? You know, that's the artist question. Well, who cares then?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It isn't addressing it.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, but it's not that it's unreachable. It's just that you have to be very careful in the ways that you think about it. And obviously, practicing the path, you have to move in very precise ways in order to get there. But to respond to your point more generally, I would say that the ways if you read about the way the Buddha acts in the Pali Canon, say, I think it's really pretty close to what you're describing here. Obviously, the conceptual framework is not the same. He's not talking about yin and yang and kind of universal energies or qi or anything like that, because he's an Indian and not Chinese. But what you described as sort of this turn that involves compassion, that somehow is, and if I'm misinterpreting you, I apologize, but it's like the nirvanic state brought into actual form and actual practice. So the Buddha's life from the age of 35 to the age of 80 is that, in a way, and it shows that this is a possibility. And similarly within the Mahayana, the ideal of the Bodhisattva is very explicitly that way, because compassion, after all, is given kind of primacy of place in the way the Bodhisattva is supposed to approach the world. And anyway.
Yeah. Compassion has density, but clarity doesn't, because clarity is God.
It has to. I mean, as you know, in Chogyam Trungpa's immortal words, we want to avoid idiot compassion. Compassion has to be joined with wisdom and discernment, or it's hopeless. That's why the kind of classic Mahayana, specifically Tibetan Buddhist image of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, which many of you may have seen. There are 1,000 hands that this bodhisattva has. He's the bodhisattva of compassion, and in each hand there's an eye, and the eye is the eye of wisdom that shows that compassion always is combined with discernment. And certainly these are the qualities that the Buddha displayed, that an arhant would display as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard that in Buddhism, in Hinduism, there's a completely different concept of time. There's in terms of cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Do these cycles keep going on and on and on, or is there a point? Stop.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer to your second question is yes. That's pretty much the way a traditional Buddhist or Hindu would understand it. There is, after all, a beginningless series of universes. So there's a big bang, and then it all collapses, and then there's another big bang. That's the way they think of it. Now, the question, is there an end to it? That's a little tricky, and the answer to that depends on whether there is a finite number of sentient beings, to use the Buddhist term, or an infinite number. If sentient beings are finite, then given enough time and enough rebirths and enough serious practice, all of us here will become arhats, will be out of samsara, and one by one, all sentient beings will do exactly the same thing, and then the very last sentient being to achieve our hot ship, you know, just sort of, okay, last one out, turn off the lights, and that's it. But if, as is more commonly said, there is an infinite number of sentient beings, then the process will just keep going forever. Now, there may be a greater or lesser infinity of enlightened versus unenlightened beings, but the process will never completely end. Yeah, and that's partly what we know from astrophysics, is partly also our deep religious roots. The very notion of Genesis is so profoundly ingrained, I think, in the culture of the West, that the idea that the universe is beginningless seems like a philosophical mistake. That it's like an infinite regress. You can't have an infinite regress. So there's a significant cultural and intellectual divide on those kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, I think you would need to draw a dividing line to some degree between Buddhism and Hinduism here, because while there are certainly strains within Hinduism whose idea of God approaches that of Western monotheistic traditions, many other Hindus have a notion of God that is more impersonal, more like the concept is called Brahman in Sanskrit. This kind of spiritual reality that is both the source and the substance of the cosmos we live in. So that's a kind of version of God. Some people, Westerners will say, oh, it's pantheistic or monistic or something like that. But in Buddhism, there is with some interesting exceptions that we don't need to go into here, there is a general rejection of the idea of a creator God. And it goes right back to the Pali Canon. There are wonderfully funny stories, actually, in the Pali Canon about the kind of make fun of Hindu creation myths, where for instance, this being, Brahma, is suddenly he arises. He says, oh, okay, I'm Brahma. I'm supposed to create the universe. And he says, okay, you know, I'm going to create people and cows and trees and plants. And all these things appear suddenly, and Brahma's quite convinced that he has created the universe. But you step outside and you take the Buddhist view on it, it's simply that Brahma himself was reborn as a Brahma by virtue of his previous karma, and these other things came into existence through various causes and conditions as well. So he mistakenly thinks that he's ordering this universe, which is actually just a result of kind of impersonal causes and conditions. So there's other stories, and there's philosophical arguments too, and it's a whole interesting area, kind of a sub area of Buddhist studies. Yes.
So between the Western concept of heaven and the Eastern concept of nirvana?
I would say to the degree that sophisticated Western concepts of heaven in say Christian theology, you know, we're not talking about harps and angels and stuff like that. We're talking about a permanent condition of absolute proximity to the fundamental reality of the cosmos. So if you want to abstract a Christian notion of heaven that way, and you want to think about nirvana or nibbana as it's certainly the condition in which there is the greatest peace and stability in the cosmos. Still, you know, I think because of the absence of a God in the Buddhist setting, it's hard to, I mean, I'm finding it's falling apart on me even as I try to argue for it. So probably not. Although I did, you know, it's interesting. I had one of my earliest teachers was a Tibetan monk by the name of Lama Yeshe, and he gave a meditation course in Indiana many, many years ago that was kind of sponsored by some, I would say, radically thinking Christian women. And in the midst of this course, one of the women asked Lama Yeshe, Lama, are God and Dharmakaya, this is this Mahayana concept of the Buddha's reality body, are God and Dharmakaya the same? And Lama Yeshe kind of sat on his throne and he blinked his eyes and he was quiet and opened and closed his eyes. And then he finally just said, yes. And that was it. And we never got an explanation. And so here's another koan for you. And you have to remember that, particularly in the Mahayana context, enlightened beings exercise what's called skillful means, which can involve telling people what they need to hear at a particular time. So if somebody else had asked him that question in a different setting, the answer might have been no. So again, we welcome to Buddhism. Any?
I have a personal question. How do you navigate being a scholar and having a discerning sort of dividing mind and your spiritual practice? And has it given rise to any moments where you flipped suddenly from one to the other and you changed your point of view?
I'd like to think that the two inform each other. I certainly think that as a teacher, I can communicate things better to my students because I'm an insider to the tradition, at least in my own Western way, right? By the same token, I've always thought that, you know, the fact that I'm a scholar can be of use to people, you know, who are serious practitioners in bringing a slightly different viewpoint to it. In my own life, I mean, it took me a long time actually to arrive at anything like a balance, and who knows if I really have, but I agonized from the moment I first met Buddhism, literally 40 years ago, almost to the day in Nepal, at least met it in a serious, sit down and meditate, damn it, way. I was wrestling with these questions of whether there are past or future lives, whether enlightenment really is possible in the ways that traditional Buddhists claim it is, and, you know, ended up, because of my intellectual nature, I suppose, ended up in grad school, but, you know, wrestled with these questions as a grad student. And, you know, I definitely went through periods, particularly in grad school, where I thought, well, you know, none of the philosophical arguments for past or future lives works. It didn't seem to me anyway. Or, you know, claims about human perfectibility just don't make any sense. That pushed me to some degree almost out of the tradition for a while. But what I realized is that one thing, being religious is not just a matter of adhering to certain doctrines and being philosophically convinced of those doctrines. Being religious is much more than that. It's a whole way of seeing and thinking and feeling. It's what I would kind of call an aesthetic. And I realized that, you know, after sort of 10 years of, you know, sort of living with Tibetans and studying Tibetan and practicing as best I could, that I was, regardless of whether I was certain about these philosophical matters, I was aesthetically a Buddhist. I kind of thought in Buddhist terms, imagined things in Buddhist ways, smelled things as a Buddhist might, and and in a way made peace with my own uncertainties. And they come up all the time. I've got friends who are sort of my age, and particularly in Madison, where I still have a lot of contacts, who are, you know, still wrestle with these questions about past and future lives and whether it matters whether there are past and future lives, whether it matters whether you can attain a state like is described in the tradition. I mean, all this is, we all wrestle with this in our own cultural setting, and I'll probably always wrestle with these. I think the two sides help each other. Now, somebody from the outside might say, no. You poor bastard. You know, you by taking the academic path, by questioning as much as you did, by doubting as much as you did, you've forestalled your, you know, you better hope that there's rebirth and that you get a good one. But, you know, we are who we are, and we take the road we do, and at the end we'll find out or we won't. Yeah.
So from what you described, Nirvana seems to be a non-dualistic state.
Yes.
Okay. Given that as it is, but when you were talking about samsara,
mm-hmm.
the system of samsara,
mm-hmm.
itself needing another state to be present, which is Nirvana,
mm-hmm.
the cessation of samsara,
mm-hmm.
kind of dualistic.
Yes. Yes. Very good. Yes, and that's one of the reasons why Nagarjuna, the great Mahayana philosopher, in his stanzas on the Middle Way, argued that samsara and nirvana are not in fact different. Because if you set them up as a duality, then that's certainly going to keep you in samsara, because dualistic thinking keeps us in samsara. Now, that wasn't all Nagarjuna meant by that. He also meant by that each of samsara and nirvana are concepts that are relative to each other. They are also concepts that, if you analyze them, don't actually stand up to reasoning. They are empty, right, in the famous Mahayana phrase. And so, you know, if samsara is simply an empty relative concept and nirvana is an empty relative concept, then they're the same. They're equal, just as you and I are equally empty and therefore equally equal. Yeah, no, good observation. Yes, sir.
Is there an informal relation between Taoism and Buddhism and
especially in what?
There's some good reading for right now.
There's not a lot of work that's been done on this. There was a Chinese influence in early Tibet, early Tibetan Buddhism in the 8th, 9th century, and there was actually a famous debate between a Chinese Zen master and some Indian pundits over whether the path to enlightenment was sudden or gradual. The whole fate of Tibetan Buddhism hung on this, if you read the traditional accounts. But there is very limited influence of Taoism in Tibet. The Tibetans have a notion that their own indigenous pre-Buddhist tradition called Pön is somehow similar to Taoism, but really, there's not a lot of this. But I should say in a broader sense that when you look at not so much at the philosophical Taoism of Lao Tzu, Zhuang Tzu, and people like that, but the so-called esoteric Taoism, which involves belief in and work within a subtle body, moving energies around and so forth, that this has strong similarities to practices that go under the general rubric of Tantra. And of course, there's a very important element of Tantra in Tibetan Buddhism. So, you know, that's probably the best place to look. And I'd have to dig around to see if there's a, I mean, if you email me, I can, and my email's on the handout. I could dig around. I can't off the top of my head tell you a text that really gets into this. Some people think there may have been historical influences even. Maybe more likely from the Chinese side to the Indian side, but it's really hard to demonstrate. The parallels are fascinating, though. Yeah.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.